Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Charles Anselm. Charles is the CEO and co-founder of Osight. Really excited because Charles is also a fellow CFA charter holder. Charles, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Christian. Great to be here. And very excited to be talking to you today.
Likewise. So, hey, let's kick things off with Osight. What problem is it solving in the market?
You may know this very well. Everybody knows this. Today, trillions of dollars in capital are moving from one place to another, in most cases in one direction, from public markets to private markets, which really causes a lot of liquidity management challenges for the various allocators. So Osight is a multi-asset portfolio management and liquidity management platform for various allocators. And we work with family office, single family offices, multi-family offices, outsourced CIOs, folks who are allocating capital to pretty much anything under the sun, like I call. So how do we help them think about their total portfolio allocation planning, risk management, rebalancing, bid order management, you name it, right? From end-to-end portfolio management of a multi-asset portfolio. That's what we do.
So, you know, it's interesting. You called out the transfer of investments from public to private. And so for the benefit of our audience who may be more familiar with companies like Apple and Google and Tesla, where you can go look up what they're currently trading on Yahoo Finance or place orders within your brokerage account, what's the significance of private assets in the world of investment and reporting?
Yeah, I think private assets actually bring a very unique source of return. There may be assets like private equity or venture capital, could be private real estate. Today, there's a lot of talk about and a lot of allocation to private debt. These private investments, they don't necessarily operate in a different universe. They operate in the same economic environment, and they are affected by the same forces in terms of market forces, you know, interest rates, currency, and economic growth. But there's a lot less transparency in terms of how these investments are made. And the allocators, the LPs who are investing in these investments in various GP funds, don't necessarily know all the details of the underlying portfolio holding companies, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the biggest things that we are bringing to the market is bringing transparency into what are the underlying holding companies doing, how are they performing, and also helping the LPs really think about their total portfolio allocation, right? You know, if you look at any investment in isolation, typically what happens is it may look fantastic on its own, but when you put it together with a bunch of other investments, guess what? A lot of the risks may be offset. And so at the total portfolio level, you may not be getting the same return or risk management expectation that you would think of when you look at any particular investment in isolation, right? So I think one of the key variables, you know, in a private market also is that if you buy a stock or a bond like Apple or Microsoft, like you mentioned, right? You say, okay, I want to buy 100 shares of Apple. So, you know, you go and say, okay, yes, go to my brokerage account. I wire them a money, you know, for whatever the price of the stock is, and you own the stock, okay? But in a private market, it's actually quite different, right? Because one, it could be two different flavors of private markets. It could be semi-liquid investments like hedge funds or other types of interval funds, but it could also be like what's called the drawdown structure funds, right? Like a private equity or venture capital. In that case, you're only making a commitment to make an investment. Say, okay, I want to invest $10 million into this private equity fund. But you're not giving them $10 million on day one. The GP is going to call you capital over time. That could take them 3 or 4 years as they find new portfolio companies to invest in. They're going to issue a capital call, right? So that presents a lot of liquidity challenges for the LP, because what are they going to do? Are they going to sit on that cash, you know, in their cash account and not earn the market return, right? They have to invest that money somewhere else. And so when that capital call does happen, they have to go get that money from some other part of their portfolio. In most cases, it could be public equity or public fixed income, and then send that money to the GP to meet that capital call. Because that's a very significant liquidity management problem. It's hard enough to do it across one portfolio, but if you're a multifamily office or an outsourced CIO working with hundreds of family offices, that becomes a huge nightmare, liquidity management. So that's one of the key things, key problems that we are solving, you know, for our clients.
So I know you and I know that we can devote a series of podcasts to portfolio management, but you touched on, you know, what for the benefit of our audience, this idea of, you know, whatever the underlying assets are in your portfolio, you have to know what they are, because one of the things that we look at as managers is correlation, right? And so obviously, if you have two identical assets, they're going to be perfectly correlated. And if you, and the lack of that transparency, you know, you may have structured your portfolio in a manner that's actually not going to respond well to market turbulence, because the assets are actually going to go in the same direction and not opposite to minimize that risk. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
I believe so. Also, I think one of the key nuances there is, as you make more and more investments, your portfolio starts looking like a general index fund, right? Again, it kind of goes back to, you know, you need to know exactly what those holding companies are in a private market, you know, in particular, also on the public market sphere, and then figure out what is the commonality across these portfolios. You talked about, variation, right? You know, there's a lot of correlation, but it's all, the more important thing is like covariance, right? How do these assets behave in terms of market stress, right? You know, are they all behaving in the same direction? Then, you know, what you may really have is a index portfolio or an passive portfolio where you're just paying a lot of money, you know, for these GPs to the 220 fees, right? So that's one of the most key things that an LP has to understand. You know, if they're allocating money to these different managers, in the end, am I just simply like putting together like a bunch of active portfolios that looks like a passive index portfolio at the total portfolio level, and am I just paying a bunch of fees, extra fees for that? You know,
so. It makes great sense. All right, so transparency, and then, you know, the other part too is just what are the scope of assets, and so obviously within a public security, it's going to be typically equities and bonds. Maybe you have some options in there, but opening this up to private, now you have real estate. Investments in private companies, you know, arguably your return and risk profile can change for the better, because you're now including assets that may be not as correlated or potentially negative correlated, but also, I mean, the sheer volume of private assets dwarfs public securities. And so how does I heard you loud and clear. One of the things that OSIGHT is doing is facilitating the investment in these on behalf of your LPs. How do you guys accomplish this?
Again, we try to focus on what we are really good at, which is total portfolio allocation planning, rebalancing, trade order management, liquidity management. So we actually partner with a lot of industry ecosystem providers, right? I like to think of OSIGHT as the central operating system. we are the control room. Right? We are the command center for our LPs, who then we connect with various data providers. Right, we work with different custodian banks. We work with data aggregators. We work with a lot of all data aggregators, because if it's a public market investment, typically you can get the holdings level detail from your custodian bank or from your brokerage. But if it's a private market investment, everything is with your GP. And typically what happens is the GP will put all that information once a quarter or, you know, once a month on their portal. So somebody has to go and get that, you know, unstructured data that's sitting on in the GP portal, take the unstructured data, extract the structured information, whether it relates to performance or holdings level details, capital calls, distributions, NAVs. So we work with various partners on the ALS data aggregation side. You know, they have all the connectivity with the various GP portals. There are thousands of GPs out there. And we bring all that data. So we bring that public market data, typically from custodian banks, and then private market data through our ALS data aggregator partners. And then we present that single pane of glass view of the total portfolio across public and private markets. It could be liquid securities, semi-liquid securities, illiquid securities. And then we help ILPs make investment decisions, but also not just make investment decisions, but also actually implement those decisions all the way to the end, right? So that's a key distinction that we do, that many reporting platforms, there are a lot of other reporting platforms out there that actually do this very similar data aggregation, but they are very focused on purely like saying, okay, yeah, here's what your position is today. Okay, now go and do whatever you want. You know? Then what do LPs do? They use these reporting platforms, put all the data into an Excel spreadsheet, and then they start thinking about investment decisions, right? So we're taking that next step, not just showing what your portfolio looks like today, but we're also helping LPs actually make investment decisions and implement those investment decisions all the way to the end. So
I'm curious, and you may have said it, but to be sure, do you currently on the roadmap facilitating liquidity or secondaries down the road, so that as LPs want to get exit positions, you can give them an
opportunity? Fantastic question, right? So it is definitely on our roadmap, right? So today we enable LPs to actually make these allocation capital call and distributions, you know, those type of workflows across multiple GPs. We also help them plan for their liquidity needs over time, right? From a pacing strategy standpoint, right? Today, you know, if I'm an LP, if I'm the chief investment officer at a large endowment, I may say, okay, my investment target to private equity is 20%. But today, I'm only at 5%, right? So there's a 15% gap in my intended target allocation, right? So what do I do with that 15% money? I'm not going to sit in cash, right? So we have investment models where you can actually invest those cash in a proxy allocation that somewhat replicates, you know, approximates the return of a risk and return profile of a private equity investment. And then when the actual capital call comes from the GP, then the system will automatically, you know, go and get the money from that public market investment and then make it available to the GP, right? So we have those type of workflows. And as part of that, right, you know, there's a lot of, in the news, right, you know, endowments like Harvard and Yale having these significant liquidity challenges, you know, because of whatever political environment that we may be in. And so, which means that they are trying to offload a lot of their private market investments in the secondary market, right? So secondary market is a very significant area that we want to invest in our product roadmap in terms of how can we facilitate our LPs to make that transaction as frictionless as possible. In a nutshell, if you were asking, what do? We try to reduce the friction of any transaction as much as possible, right? Today, LPs may take weeks or days to kind of come up and make like one simple transaction in an illiquid security, right? We can cut that transaction, you know, the friction in that transaction by like 95%. We can do a lot of these things that LPs do today that takes them days to do. We can just do it with a push of a button, right? So, and the next step is like, okay, how can you build these agentic AI frameworks to actually do it for the LP, right? That way the LPs can focus on their more high value investment decisions that requires a lot of trade-offs, right? And we take care of all the systematic decisions like rebalancing or turnover management or cash flow management or liquidity management. Right?
Brilliant. I mean, congratulations. It sounds like you've not only built a product, but your vision, I mean, I, personally, being active in the space, I mean, it sounds like you're on the right track, and really exciting to see what comes. I have a bunch more questions on a site, but before I get to them, I'd love to take a step back. Love to learn about your career progression and how it led to you starting the company.
Yeah, great. I'm an immigrant. You know, I came to this country almost 30 years ago with a bag of clothes and a couple hundred dollars in my pocket. I went to school at Iowa State. I studied civil engineering, but I never actually worked as a civil engineer. I worked in the telecom industry for several years, right around the time of the Y2K crisis. Kind of ages me, you know. We were right in the middle of that Y2K crisis, you know, the dot-com boom and bust. I was in the telecom industry, kind of went through that ups and downs of that cycle in that particular industry. And then after that, coming out of that, I really wanted to be part of the capital market. Even though I'm a first-time entrepreneur, I've always thought of myself as a very entrepreneurial person. To get on a plane that you know, and then come halfway across the world and start a new life, you know, it takes that risk-taking mindset, right? So I always had that mindset in me. And so I wanted to do something interesting, especially in the capital market side. So I went back to school, went back to grad school. So I went to University of Texas, you know, McCombs School of Business in Austin, Texas. I did my MBA there. And then after that is when I moved to Seattle almost 20 years ago, working for Washington Mutual, and which is now acquired by JP Morgan during the global financial crisis. And then during around the same time, you know, I actually started working at Russell Investments, which is really where I cut my teeth in terms of like asset management, trading, and working with these large institutional investors, right? So, and during the 2008 financial crisis, I was deep in the middle of trading these various types of financial weapons of mass destruction that Warren Buffett talks about, right? So I was right in the middle of that, working with, you know, these large investment banks, you know, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, on behalf of these large institutional investors. And again, that's really where I really understood the value of risk management, right? So how do you think about it? It's one thing to take risks, but also you need to know, you know, how do you manage those risks, you know, in a systematic way? And so having seen the dot-com boom and bust and then during the financial crisis, you know, it really kind of had a lasting impact on me. I was working at Russell for a long time. And then prior to founding OSIGHT, I was a head of portfolio management at another outsourced CIO firm. And we were a team of seven people. We were managing $5 billion in assets for 21 different endowments and foundations. And we would have 21 different spreadsheets. We called them trading sheets, which didn't make the trading platform anyway. But we would spend 75% of our time simply trying to figure out which manager did we give money to and what's the asset allocation for any given client before we can make any real investment decision. Okay, managing liquidity across these multiple investments was absolute chaos. In many ways, that's where my risk management hat came into play, right? Okay, I could have said, you know, this is a very scary job, right? Because I really didn't know what the heck we were investing in and why, right? And before we were not very clear as to what value are we adding to our clients, right? That was the aha moment for me. That was when the light bulb went off, right? Okay, I am not the only investor who's struggling with these challenges of allocating across public and private markets, liquid and illiquid security. There are thousands of, in fact, there are tens of thousands of investors like me who have the same challenge, right? And this is where it makes me a very unique person, right? Most people in my shoes would probably say, no, I don't like this job. I'm going to go find a better job. Maybe I want to be the CIO at an endowment fund, you know? And I said, no. I'm actually going to go solve this problem because I care so deeply about this problem. I want to do everything possible. I'm going to go and solve this problem, right? I think that was the motivation for us to, you know, the reason for founding OSIGHT. So,
wow. I have to ask. One of the aspects of culture in the United States is an acceptance that it's okay to fail. I've been to some parts of the world, but not by no means every country. But know that that's unique to the U.S. I'm curious, did you find that in fact was your experience, or were you just always, did you just have such a strong entrepreneurial streak that it was inconsequential and you knew that this is what you wanted to do?
I think being here and seeing the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people, that's been a total mindset change for me, right? Where I came from, you know, most people are very risk averse, right? So, but I think this is this unique American entrepreneurial spirit, right? That is unbelievable. And we work with clients today in the UK, even our clients tell us, right? They're like, you guys are doing something that's very, very interesting. And we can only do these type of things in the US. I think we have this innate structure, you know, in our economy, in terms of a risk-taking culture, where it's actually okay to fail, right? We are a 25, 30-person team, right? we are working with some of the most sophisticated investors on this planet. And there's a reason for that, right? If I weren't sitting in, say, in Europe, somewhere in France or in India or China, I don't think I'll be able to do this at all, right? So regardless of how entrepreneurial I am. So I think a lot of kudos. I mean, I love this country. You know, it's been an American today, you know, been long, but it's been a phenomenal journey for me personally, as a longtime immigrant. So.
Well, I appreciate you sharing. You know, I think for people who are born and raised in the U.S., they may not necessarily appreciate the fact that that's unique to our country, and it's not necessarily the case everywhere. So, you know, appreciate you sharing your experience. So, what year did you start Offsite?
We started in Q1 of 2021, right in the middle of COVID, when everything was shut down. My kindergarten, my second child who was in kindergarten at the time, you have your kids on online school, which was quite a nightmare scenario back then. But my co-founder and I came together at that time, and you're like, okay, we know there's a significant problem here. And we're going to go solve it. We raised a small friends and family round, you know, in Q1, hired our first developer, and that's how we got started. That's when we got started. As you know very well, fintech, especially asset management technology, what we're really selling is trust. Mm-hmm. Technology is technology. What we're selling really is trust. And the typical MVP of the Silicon Valley startup, right, doesn't sell in our industry. I'm sure you know this very well, right? So we had to put in a lot of effort, and we had to get the platform to a certain level of threshold in terms of quality, cybersecurity, regulatory controls. So it took us about 2 years to kind of get our platform to that point. We had to get SOC 2 Type 2 certification before we can even sign our first proof of concept client, right? So yeah, late 2023 is when we signed our first client as a proof of concept. Phenomenal client, you know, amazing client partner in New York, a 30 billion AUM multifamily office. You know, we've worked with hundreds of family offices on the East Coast. Today we have several clients, and if you put all of our clients together, you know, their assets, you know, maybe somewhere close to like 100 billion in assets under management.
Congratulations.
It's been a great, you know, we are very grateful that, you know, these large institutional investors trusting us to do this very important work every single day. You know, we are there as the central control room, right, where they actually get their jobs done on a day-to-day basis for their clients, right?
You know, it's interesting. Something you said, I think, is really worth highlighting, and that is, you know, everyone, I think at this point, a lot of entrepreneurs are familiar with the concept of a minimum viable product. And there's no shortage of books, blog posts, podcasts, you know, devoted to this idea of get to market as absolutely fast as you can. You know, because if you're going to fail, it's best to do it as quickly as possible so you learn. But, you know, you highlight that there are some industries where you don't have that luxury. You have to, you know, because your buyers are only going to be satisfied with a piece of software that solves some pretty complex needs, and by consequence, it has longer development cycles. So thank you for sharing. I think that's valuable to call out because it's not a one size fits all concept. And you mentioned raising capital, friends and family. What was your experience raising outside capital from professional investors?
Yeah, last year we raised a institutional seed round. We have some amazing investors. Again, very thankful to, you know, Moneta Ventures. They're in Sacramento, and then 630 Ventures is another notable other large investors. And of course, we have other smaller investors as well. They've been phenomenal partners in terms of helping us think through the ICP, and thinking through what our product needs to do. I think before we started this conversation, right, I was telling you one of the main reasons why clients buy from Offsite is because of the domain expertise that we bring, right? Because myself, our team, we have sat in our clients' chairs, we have struggled with the same problems, we have in terms of allocation, liquidity, trading, rebalancing, and we have kind of brought that investment domain expertise and we have built it into the product, right? Yesterday it was SaaS and cloud computing and machine learning. Today it's like agentic AI and large language models. Tomorrow it could be something else. It doesn't really matter, right? What we bring that's different, you know, everybody has access to the same technology, right? What we do that's different is that access to that private data set from a client, and then bring our own secret sauce from an investment management standpoint, right? That is not going to change, right? So I think the VCs that you know who have given us money were able to recognize that, right? They were like, okay, I see that you are the domain expert, and your team is the domain expert. So I think that's why that partnership with these VCs has actually worked out quite well. So.
Well, you know, I think you bring up, so thanks for sharing that, because I think it's another very relevant topic. So obviously AI is front and center. There's probably consensus that if you were to go out and build your own AI tools, you're gonna require a significant amount of computer science domain expertise. But you and I also know there's only so much time in the day. And invariably, the time that you spent in wealth management, portfolio management, OSITE wouldn't be possible without that portion of your career. And so, is it a long way of saying is it fair to say that yes, you have strong technical capabilities within the company, but in the absence of having spent time in the industry, this company would have been a lot more difficult to bring to life.
Absolutely, right? I think we're not the first people to try and solve this problem, right? People have tried this 10, 15 years ago. One, there was no technology, wasn't as available back then as it is today. So in many ways, we are fortunate that we have access to these various technology, various tools that allows us to do what we do. But also a lot of the companies, you know, in this fintech space that were founded 10, 15 years ago, but really not, were founded by either technologists or operations folks who really didn't have that investment domain knowledge, right? I think that's the key thing that, you know, that we are bringing to the market. And my vision is that we are working with some of the most sophisticated investors on the planet today. How can we bring those sophisticated institutional level allocation management capabilities across public and private markets to every single advisor or wealth manager in this world, right? That's our long-term vision. And that's where the industry is going. You know, the CAIA, you know, the Chartered Alternative Investment Association, they put on this, you know, they always talk about this portfolio of the future, right? Which is a multi-asset portfolio. The portfolio of that future, you know, it has both public markets, it has private markets. And that's what every single investor wants to invest in going forward. But there are like certain roadblocks that we have to be aware of. And I definitely don't think that the industry is ready, especially the advisory industry is ready or has the infrastructure to actually help their clients allocate to these various markets. Right? And that's the, I like to think of us as the core infrastructure layer for enabling these advisors to make these wise decisions on behalf of their clients, regardless of what asset type or, you know, public market or private market, liquid or illiquid security that they're allocating to.
You know, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, transparency and liquidity are just core at the issue, and you're solving for it. So, I mean, I'm super excited for you and really looking forward to seeing how the journey plays out. And so with that, you know, I'd love to know, how do you think about building the company? And we can start, love to know your thoughts on culture, whether it's deliberate or you find that it happens naturally. And then from there, just, you know, how do you think about growth? You know, where are you allocating OSITE's capital? Is, you know, do you yeah. feel like it's more appropriate to focus on product development or sales and marketing?
Yeah, good questions, right? I'll touch upon the, you know, how we think about culture, right? I'm a first-time entrepreneur. You know, when I first started OSITE, I didn't have this big business plan. I didn't even know what an ICP was. When investors come and ask me, tell me what your ICP is. I'm like, I didn't know, right? So, but we were so passionate about the problem because we knew this could be a significant problem for the industry, right? So that's how we got started. But over time, you know, we learned, right? However, I think culture is a very important aspect of building a business. I made some mistakes in the past in terms of hiring fast and not firing fast. You can't have both, right? You know, it's okay to hire slow, hire fast, but then you need to also be able to fire fast, right? So I've hired people because, you know, because I believe that, you know, they have a certain skill set that we needed to solve some of the complex problems that we had, that we were solving for our clients. And, you know, when you work with a lot of smart people, you don't all necessarily see eye to eye, and we're not on the same page, right? So Reid Hoffman says that you have to have like strong opinions loosely held, right? I never thought about that, right? So a lot of the people, challenges that I had in terms of building a team culture early on, you know, was hiring people for their skill sets and we're not all on the same page, right? So, and I also made the mistake of not firing those people soon enough, right? Again, it was me, you know, being afraid. Okay, what's going to happen if you let go of this person? You know, we don't have anybody else to do their job that they were doing, right? So, but I think going forward, I'm very mindful of who we bring in. In the last 4 years, we've been kind of like on that slow burn and slow growth, but we are at a point where, you know, we have a significant demand for what we do, and we could be closing a bunch of enterprise clients in the next 12 months, and we may have to go and double the size of the team from like 25 or 30 people to like 50 or 60 people, right, in the next 6 to 12 months, right, which means, you know, we have to hire fast. But at the same time, you know, we have to have a really credible process in terms of like bringing in the right people who have the same mindset, same culture as you know that I want to, you know, have the entire team to have. So that's on the culture side. In terms of how I'm spending my time and energy right now, I'm a firm believer. You know, there's always this thing about product-led growth versus like marketing-led growth. I don't think it's either or. It has to be both. Okay, to be blunt and to be open and a little bit more vulnerable with you, right? I think our marketing has been running a little bit further ahead of what our product can be. I think there's still a gap between what we say between marketing and product. And so I think the next 6 months, our focus should be as a business to be on making sure that the product delivers what we say in our marketing. And I think clients are already seeing that, but I think we need to do a better job of that. And so to me, our focus is going to be really on product, making sure that, you know, we can scale as we're closing these large enterprise clients. How do we scale them? How do we get value that we promise to these clients, you know, as quickly as possible? But also at the same time, you know, we cannot take our eye off the ball in terms of communicating, you know, what we do to the broader marketplace, right? I think our ICP has been growing significantly. We started off in a very, very narrow focus, right? So outsourced CIOs who are working with, you know, institutional foundations and endowments, right? And we're like, okay, now, you know, let's take a step back. And there the minimum investment size was $100 million, right? Now we're like, okay, now can we now broaden it out? And now can we work with multifamily offices or like, you know, who are working with these ultra high net worth, you know, families, right? But their minimum investment size may be like $25 or $50 million, right? The next step would be like, how can we take this institutional product and simplify that? As I said, we can work with any advisor who's working with these high net worth, you know, individuals, where the minimum investment size could be like 2 million or 3 million, right? So as we simplify the product while preserving the sophistication of what we do from an allocation standpoint, and if you make it available to, and then our ICP keeps growing, right, from like 1,000 to 10,000 to 50,000 to 100,000. So it's a very exciting journey where we're on today, and to do that, to get to where we were, where the vision of where we want to get the company to, I think we have to be focused both on the product and the marketing. That's going to go hand in hand, you know, and education of our clients in terms of what we do and what are the problems that they're facing or they're going to be facing when they're allocating across public and private markets. I think that's going to be a key component of what we do and what we bring to the market. So.
Yeah. So, you know, as I listen, I mean, what I hear is, you know, the fact that you called out your domain expertise is paying spades. You know who your buyers are. It sounds like you know exactly where their pain points are. You know how to solve them. But at the same time, you know, you have to get the word out, because I imagine you compete with Excel a lot, and but.
Inertia and Excel is what we compete with mostly. Although I'm very grateful. We are a market of one. We are a category of one. Like Tim Ferriss says, you got to build a category of one company, right? We are a category of one company today. When we look at multi-asset portfolio management, there is nobody else who can do what we do today.
I love it. Charles, you know, unfortunately, we're near the end of the podcast. Before we wrap up, a little bit of reflection. If you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self, and you can pick the age, what would you share?
I think it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. No matter what I do, it's going to be okay, right? We all think about risks very differently. We're like, oh, what's going to happen if I were to take that job or say no to that job, or it's all going to be okay. One of the best advice that I got from a friend of mine is go for a walk. Go for a walk. No matter
Great.
what the problem is, go for a walk. So that's what I would say to my younger self too, right? No matter what you're dealing with today, go for a walk. It'll be okay.
Very practical. And I would second it. There's something about just stepping away and moving the body that does wonders.
Absolutely.
Charles, and anyone in your career that you'd like to give a shout out to who had a meaningful impact on who you are today?
In the last few years, I've came to know this person, who's actually one of my investors today. His name is John Herlocker. He's a fellow entrepreneur, from Seattle. Brilliant, brilliant, PhD mathematician, computer scientist. He had a couple of companies that he's built. He's actually the former CTO of VMware. And so he's one of my investors today. I really look up to him. He's become a great friend and mentor. So John, shout out to you. Thanks for taking a bet on me a few years ago and helping me along the way in this entrepreneurial journey. So I every day I learn something new from him. Every time I meet him, every time I talk to him, always learn something new from him. So
Fantastic. Shout out to John.
yeah.
Charles, if there are any members of our audience who'd like to get a hold of you or want to learn more about Osite, how can they find you?
Yeah, the best way to find me is on LinkedIn, Charles Anselm. My email, it's charles@osite.com, OSYTE. It's a wordplay on oversight, investment oversight of complex portfolios. That's what we do. So you can reach me
Brilliant.
on email, you can reach me on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Charles, thank you again. I appreciate your time and your perspective and insights, extremely valuable. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Charles Anselm. Charles is the CEO and co-founder of Osite. Charles, thank you.
Christian, thank you so much. It was fun, and I definitely enjoyed talking to you today.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of Finstrat Management. This has been another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @FinstratMGMT. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.